round her neck. Three Gilliconese girls dressed like women for hire. More children in a pack, running and squealing like piglets, pressing up against a merchant to pick his pockets. Rag merchants with pushcarts. Kiosk keepers whose goods lay locked beneath safety grills. And a sort of civil army, if you could call it that, strolling in foursomes on every second or third street, brandishing clubs, angular with swords. They paid the carriage master and walked with their parcels of clothes toward the palace. It rose in stepped-back fashion, a growth of domes and minarets, high-flared buttresses in green marble, blue agate screens in the recessed windows. Central and most prominent, the broad, gentle-browed canopies of the pagoda lifted over the throne room, covered with hammered scales of virgin gold, brilliant in the late afternoon gloom. 5 days later, they had made it past the gatekeeper, the receptionists, and the social secretary. They had sat for hours awaiting a 3-minute interview with the commander-general of audiences. Elphaba, a hard, twisted look on her face, had managed to eject the words, "Madame Morrible," from between her clamping lips.
"Tomorrow at 11," said the commander-general, "you will have 4 minutes between the ambassador to Ix and the matron of the Ladies' Home Guard Social Nourishment Brigade. Dress code is formal."
He handed them a card of regulations that, being unequipped with courtly dress, they were obliged to ignore. At 3 the following afternoon, everything running late, the ambassador to Ix left the throne room looking agitated and splenetic. Glinda fluffed the bedraggled feathers in her travelling hat for the 80th time, and sighed, "Now you're the one who says what should be said." Elphaba nodded. To Glinda she looked tired, terrified, but strong, as if her form were knit with iron and whiskey instead of bones and blood. The commander-general of audiences appeared in the doorway of the waiting salon.
"You have 4 minutes," he said. "Do not approach until you are bade to do so. Do not speak until you are addressed. Do not venture a remark unless it is to answer a comment or question. You may refer to the wizard as Your Highness."
"That sounds pretty regal to me. I thought that royalty had been..." But here Glinda elbowed Elphaba to make her shut up. Really, Elphaba had no common sense sometimes. They hadn't come so far just to be turned away because of adolescent radicalism. The commander-general took no notice. As they approached a set of tall double doors, carved with sigils and other occult hieroglyphs, the commander-general mentioned,
"The wizard is not in a good humor today, due to the reports of a riot in the Ugabu district in the north of Winky country. I should be prepared for what I find, were I you."
Two stoical doormen opened the doors then, and they passed through. But the throne did not lie before them. Instead, the antechamber led left, and through an archway there was another, but on a shifting axis to the right, and another beyond that, and another. It was like looking through a reflection of a corridor and mirrors set opposite each other. It veered inward. Or, thought Glinda, like processing through the narrowing, deviating chambers of a nautilus. They made a circuit through 8 or 10 salons, each slightly smaller than the other, each steeped in a curdled light that fell from leaded panes above. At last, the antechambers concluded at an archway into a cavernous circular hall, higher than it was wide, and dark as a chapel. Antique wrought-iron stands held ziggurats of molded beeswax, burning with a multitude of wicks, and the air was close and slightly flowery. The wizard was absent, though they saw the throne on a circular dais, inset emeralds gleaming dully in the candlelight.
"He stepped out to use the toilet," said Elphaba. "Well, we'll wait."
They stood at the archway, not daring to venture farther without invitation.
"If we only have 4 minutes, I hope this doesn't count," said Glinda. "I mean, it took us 2 minutes just to get from there to here."
"At this point," said Elphaba, and then, "Shh."
Glinda shhed. She didn't think she heard anything. Then she wasn't sure.
There was no change that she could identify in the gloom, but Elphaba looked like a pointer on alert. Her chin was out, her nose high and nostrils flared, her dark eyes squinting and widening.
"What?" said Glinda. "What?"
"The sound of..."
Glinda heard no sounds, unless it was the hot air lifting from the flames into the chilly shadows between dark rafters. Or was it the rustle of silk robes? Was the wizard approaching? She looked this way and that. No. There was a rustle, a sort of hiss, as of bacon rashers in a skillet. The candle flames suddenly all genuflected, obeisant to a sour wind that beat from the area of the throne. Then the dais was pelted with thick drops of rain, and a shudder of homegrown thunder blatted out more dropped kitchen kettles than timpani. On the throne was a skeleton of dancing lights. At first Glinda thought lightning, but then she realized it was luminescent bones hitched together to suggest something vaguely human, or at least mammalian. The ribcage flexed open like two fretted hands, and a voice spoke in the storm, not from the skull, but from the dark eye of the storm where the heart of the lightning creature should be, in the tabernacle of the ribcage.
"I am Oz, the great and terrible," it said, and shook the room with its related weather. "Who are you?"
Glinda glanced at Elphaba.
"Go on, Elphi," she said, nudging her.
But Elphaba looked terrified. Well, of course, the rain. She had that thing about rainstorms.
"Who are you?" bellowed the thing. The Wizard of Oz, whatever.
"Elphi," hissed Glinda.
Then,
"Oh, you useless thing, all talk and no—"
"I'm Glinda, from Frotica, if you please, Your Highness, descended matrilineally from the Arduenas of the Upland. And this, if you please, is Elphaba, the Thropp third descending from Nest Hardings, if you please."
"And if I don't, please," said the wizard.
"Oh, really? How like a child," said Glinda under her breath.
"Elphi, come on. I can't say why we're here."
But the banal comment of the wizards seemed to snap Elphaba out of her terror. Staying where she was at the edge of the room, gripping Glinda's hand for support, Elphaba said,
"We're students of Madame Morrible at Crage Hall in Shiz, Your Highness, and we're in possession of some vital information."
"We are?" said Glinda. "Thanks for telling me."
The small rain seemed to let up a bit, though the room stayed dark as an eclipse.
"Madame Morrible, that paragon of paradoxes," said the wizard. "Vital information of her, I wonder?"
"No," said Elphaba. "That is, it is not for us to interpret what we hear. Gossip is unreliable, but—"
"Gossip is instructive," said the wizard. "It tells which way the wind is blowing."
The wind then blew in the direction of the girls, and Elphaba danced back to avoid being spattered.
Go ahead, girls. Gossip.
No, said Elphaba. We're here on more important business.
Elfie, said Glinda, do you want to get us thrown in prison?
Who are you to decide what is important business? Roared the wizard.
I keep my eyes open, said Elphaba. You didn't call us here to ask for our gossip. We came with our own agenda.
How do you know I didn't call you here?
Well, they didn't know, especially after whatever it was had happened to them at tea with Madame Morrible.
Scale down, Elfie, whispered Glinda. You're making him mad.
So what? Elphaba said. I'm mad. She spoke up again.
I have news of the murder of a great scientist and a great thinker, Your Highness. I have news of important discoveries that he was making, and their suppression. I have every interest in the pursuit of justice, and I know you do too, so that the amazing revelations of Dr. Dillamond will help you to reverse your recent judgments on the rights of animals.
Dr. Dillamond, said the wizard, is that what all this is about?
It is about an entire population of animals systematically deprived of their...
I know of Dr. Dillamond, and I know of his work, said the glowing bones of the wizard, snorting. Derivative, unauthenticated, specious garbage. What you'd expect of an academic animal... Predicated on shaky political notions, empiricism, quackery, tomfoolery, cant, rant, and rhetoric. Were you taken in, perhaps, by his enthusiasm, his animal passion?
The skeleton danced a jig, or perhaps it was a twitch of disgust.
I know of his interests and his findings. I know little of what you call his murder, and I care less.
I am not a slave to emotions, Elphaba said sternly. She was pulling papers from her sleeve, where she had apparently rolled them up around her arm. This is not propaganda, Your Highness. This is a well-argued theory of consciousness inclination, is what he calls it. And you will be amazed to learn of his discoveries. No right-thinking ruler can afford to ignore the implique.
That you presume me to be right-thinking is touching, said the wizard. You may drop the things where you stand, unless you prefer to approach.
The lightning marionette grinned and stretched out its arms.
My pet...
Elphaba dropped the papers.
"Good, my lord," she said in a piercing, pretentious voice. "I shall take you to be right-thinking, for did I not, I should be obliged to join an army against you."
"Oh, hell, Elfie," said Glinda, then more loudly, "she doesn't speak for the both of us, Your Highness. I'm an independent person here."
"Please,"
said Elphaba, at once hard and soft, proud and pleading. Glinda realized she had never before witnessed Elphaba wanting anything.
"Please, sir. The hardship on the animals is more than can be borne. It isn't just the murder of Dr. Dillamond. It's this forced repatriation, this chattelizing of free beasts. You must get out and see the sorrow. There is worry that the next step will be slaughter and cannibalism. This isn't merely youthful outrage. Please, sir, this is not untrammeled emotion. What's happening is immoral."
"I do not listen when anyone uses the word immoral," said the wizard. "In the young it is ridiculous. In the old it is sententious and reactionary, and an early warning sign of apoplexy.
in the middle-aged, who love and fear the idea of moral life the most. It is hypocritical.
If not immoral, then what word can I use to imply wrong? Said Elphaba.
Try mysterious, and then relax a little. The thing is, my green girlie, it is not for a girl or a student or a citizen to assess what is wrong. This is the job of leaders, and why we exist.
But then nothing would keep me from assassinating you, did I not know what wrong was. I don't believe in assassination. I don't even know what it means, Glinda called. Yoo-hoo! I'm going to take my leave now, while I'm still alive.
Wait, said the wizard. I have something to ask you.
They stood still. They stood for minutes. The skeleton fingered its ribs, played them like the brittle strings of a harp. Music like stones turning over in a stream bed. The skeleton collected its lighted teeth from its jaws and juggled them. Then it tossed them at the seat of the throne, where they exploded in candy-colored flashes. The rain was running down a drain in the floor, Glinda noticed.
"Madame Morrible," said the wizard, "agent provocateur and gossip, crony and companion, teacher and minister, tell me why she sent you here."
"She didn't," said Elphaba.
"Do you even know the meaning of the word pawn?" shrieked the wizard.
"Do you know what resistance means?" Elphaba shot back. But the wizard only laughed instead of killing them on the spot.
"What does she want of you?"
Glinda spoke up. It was about time. "A decent education. For all her bombastic ways, she's a capable administrator. It can't be easy." Elphaba was staring at her with a queer, slanted look.
"Has she brought you in?"
Glinda didn't quite understand. "We're only sophisters. We have only begun to specialize, I in sorcery, Elphaba in life sciences."
"I see," the wizard seemed to consider. "And after you graduate next year?"
"I suppose I'll go back to Frotica and get married."
"And you?"
Elphaba didn't answer.
The wizard turned itself around, broke off its femurs, and pounded the seat of the throne as if it were a kettle drum.
"Really, this is getting ridiculous. It's all pleasure, faith, showbiz," said Elphaba. She took a step or two forward. "Excuse me, Your Highness, before our time is up." The wizard turned back. Its skull was on fire, a fire not quenched by the thickening curtain of rain.
"I shall say one last thing," the wizard ventured, in a voice like a groan, a voice of one in pain. "I shall quote from the Ossiad, the hero tale of ancient Oz."
The girls waited. The Wizard of Oz recited,
"Then, hobbling like a glacier, old Cambrisia rubs the naked sky till it rains with blood. She tears the skin off the sun and eats it hot. She tucks the sickle moon in her patient purse. She bears it out, a full-grown changeling stone. Shard by shard she rearranges the world. It looks the same, she says, but it is not. It looks as they expect, but it is not." "Beware whom you serve," said the Wizard of Oz.
Then he was gone, and the gutters in the floor gurgled, and the candles went instantly out. There was nothing for them to do but retrace their steps. At the carriage, Glinda had settled in and made a little nest for them in the desirable forward-facing seat, guarding Elphaba's place against three other passengers. "My sister," she lied. "I am saving this seat for my sister." And how I have changed, she thought, in a year and some, from despising the colored girl to claiming we are blood. So university life does change you in ways you cannot guess. I may be the only person in all the Pertha Hills ever to meet our wizard. Not on my own steam, not of my initiative. Still, I was there, I did it, and we're not dead. But we didn't accomplish much. Then there was Elfie at last, barreling along the paving stones with her elbows jutting and her thin, bony torso swathed against the elements, as usual, in a cape. She came up through the crowd, batting at more refined passengers to get past, and Glinda shoved open the door. "Thank heavens, I thought you'd be late," she said. "The driver is eager to leave. Did you get a lunch for us?" Elphaba tossed in her lap a couple of oranges, a hunk of unrepentant cheese, and a loaf of bread that filled the compartment with pungent staleness. "This'll have to do till you're stopped this evening," she said. "Me? Me?" said Glinda. "What do you mean, me? Have you got something better to eat for yourself?"
"Something worse, I expect," said Elphaba, "but needs to be done. I've come to say goodbye. I'm not going back with you to Crage Hall. I'll find a place to study on my own. I'll not be part of Madame Morrible's school again."
"No, no," cried Glinda. "I can't let you. Nanny will eat me alive. Nessa Rose will die. Madame Morrible will... Elfie, no, no."
"Tell them I kidnapped you and made you come here. They'll believe that of me," said Elphaba. She stood on the mounting tread, a fat, Glican female dwarf, having caught the gist of the drama, shifted to the more comfortable seat next to Glinda. "They needn't look for me, Glinda, for I'm not going to be findable. I'm going down."
"Down where? Back to Quaddling country?"
"That would be telling," Elphaba said. "But I won't lie to you, my dear. No need to lie. I don't know yet where I'm going. I haven't decided, so I wouldn't have to lie."
"Elfie, get in this cab. Don't be a fool," Glinda cried.
The driver was adjusting the reins and yelling at Elphaba to sod off.
"You'll be all right," Elphaba said. "Now you're a seasoned traveler. This is just the return leg of a voyage you already know."
She put her face against Glinda's and kissed her.
"Hold out if you can," she murmured, and kissed her again. "Hold out, my sweet."
The driver clucked the reins and pitched a cry to leave. Glinda craned her head to see Elphaba drift back into the crowds. For all her singularity of complexion, it was astounding how quickly she became camouflaged in the ragamuffin variety of street life in the Emerald City. Or maybe it was foolish tears blurring Glinda's vision. Elphaba hadn't cried, of course. Her head had turned away quickly as she stepped down, not to hide her tears, but to soften the fact of their absence. But the sting to Glinda was real. Part 3. City of Emeralds. On a clammy late summer evening about 3 years after graduating from Shiz University,
Fiero stopped at the Unionist Chapel in St. Glinda's Square to pass some time before meeting a fellow countryman at the opera. Fiero hadn't taken to Unionism as a student, but he had developed an eye for frescoes that often adorned the cubbyholes of older chapels. He was hoping to find a portrait of St. Glinda. He had not seen Glinda of the Arduenas of the Uplands since her graduation. She had finished a year before he did. But he hoped it wouldn't be sacrilegious to light a charm-wax candle in front of St. Glinda's likeness and to think of her namesake. A service was ending, and the congregation of sensitive adolescent boys and black-scarved grandmothers drifted slowly out. Fiero waited until the lyre player in the nave had finished fingering a tricky diminuet. Then he approached her. "Do forgive me. I'm a visitor from the West." Well, obviously, with his rich ochre skin color and tribal markings. "I don't see a sexton, a verger, a sacristan, whatever the word is, nor can I find a pamphlet to tell me. I was looking to find an icon of St. Glinda." Her face remained grave. "You'll be lucky if it hasn't been papered over with a poster of our glorious wizard. I'm an itinerant musician, only through this way once in a while. But I think you might look in the last aisle. There's an oratory to St. Glinda, or used to be. Good luck." Locating it, a tomb-like space with an archer's slit instead of a true window, Fiero saw, lit by a pinkish sanctuary light, a smoky image of the saint, leaning a bit to the right. The portrait was merely sentimental and not robustly primitive, a disappointment. Water damage had made great white stains like laundry soap mistakes on the saint's holy garments. He couldn't remember her particular legend, nor the uplifting way that she had gagged on death for the sake of her soul and for the edification of her admirers. But then he saw, in the underwatery shadows, that the oratory was inhabited by a penitent. The head was bowed in prayer, and he was about to move away when it struck him that he knew who it was. "Elphaba," he said. She turned her head slowly, a lace shawl dropped to her shoulders. Her hair was looped on her head and skewered with ivory hair corkscrews. Her eyes batted once or twice slowly, as if she were moving toward him from a great distance away. He had interrupted her at prayer. He hadn't remembered her to be religious. Maybe she didn't recognize him. "Elphaba, it's Fiero," he said, moving into the doorway, blocking her exit, and also the light. Suddenly he couldn't see her face, and wondered if he heard correctly when she said, "I beg your pardon, sir." "Elfie, I'm Fiero. We were at Chiz," he said. "My splendid Elfie, how are you?" "Sir, I believe you are mistaking me for someone else," she said, in Elphaba's voice. "Elphaba, the Throp Third Descending, if I remember the nomenclature," he said, laughing stoutly. "I'm not mistaken at all. I'm Fiero of the Arjikis. You know me. You remember me. From Dr. Nicodick's lectures in the life sciences." "You have confused yourself," she said. "Sir." That last word sounded a bit shirty. Absolutely Elphaba. "Now you don't mind if I am about my devotions in peace." She drew her shawl up above her head and arranged it to fall about her temples. The chin in profile could slice a salami, and even in the low light he knew he wasn't wrong. "What is it?" he said. "Elfie. Well, Miss Elphaba, if you require. Don't shab me off like this. Of course it's you. There's no disguising you. What game are you about? She didn't answer him in words, but by telling her beads ostentatiously, she was telling him to get lost.
I'm not going, he said. You're interrupting my meditation, sir, she said softly. Do I have to call the verger and have you removed?
I'll meet you outside, he said. How long do you need to pray?
Half an hour, an hour, I'll wait.
In an hour, then, across the street, there's a small public fountain with some benches. I'll talk with you for 5 minutes, 5 minutes only, and show you that you've made a mistake. Not a serious one, but increasingly annoying to me.
Forgive the intrusion. In an hour, then. Elphaba.
He wasn't going to let her get away with whatever game she was playing. He withdrew, however, and went to the musician at the back of the nave.
"Is there another exit to this building besides the main doors?" he asked, over her spurts of arpeggio.
When it was convenient to answer him, she tucked her head and moved her eyes.
"Side door through to the cloister of the Monts. It's not open to the public, but you can get out to a servant's delivery alley through there."
He lingered in the shadow of a pillar. In about 40 minutes, a cloaked figure entered the chapel and moved, hobbling with a cane, directly to the oratory Elfie occupied. He was too far away to hear if words were exchanged or anything else. Perhaps the newcomer was merely another disciple of St. Glinda and wanted solitude to pray. The figure didn't linger. It left again as quickly as its stiff joints would allow. Fiero dropped an offering in the poor box, a note, so to avoid the clink of coin. In a quarter of the city so infested with the urban poor, his situation of comparative wealth required the penitential gift, though his motivation was characterized more by guilt than charity. Then he slipped out through the side door, into an overgrown cloister garden. Some ancient women in wheeled chairs were chortling at the far end and didn't notice him. He wondered if Elphaba belonged to this community of monastic nuns, Monts they were called. He now remembered that they were females living in that most paradoxical of institutions, a community of hermits. Apparently, however, their vows of silence were revoked in the decay of old age. He decided that Elphaba couldn't have changed that much in 5 years, so he let himself out the servant's entrance into an alleyway. 3 minutes passed, and Elphaba emerged from the same servant's entrance as he had suspected she would. She was intent on avoiding him. Why? Why? The last he had seen of her, he remembered it well, was the day of Amma Clutch's funeral and the drunken party at the pub. She had fled to the Emerald City on some obscure mission, never to return, while he had been dragged off to the eye-opening joys and terrors of the Philosophy Club. Rumor held that the great-grandfather, the eminent Throp, had engaged agents to look for her in Shiz in the Emerald City. From Elphaba herself, there was never a postcard, never a message, never a clue. Nessa Rose had been inconsolable at first, and then grew to resent her sister's putting her through this pain of separation. Nessa had lost herself deeper in religion, to the point where her friends had begun to avoid her. Tomorrow, Fiero would make his apologies for missing the opera and standing up his business colleague. Tonight he would not lose Elphaba. As she hurried through the streets, checking over her shoulder more than once, he thought, if you were trying to lose someone, if you did think someone was on your trail, this is the time of day to do it, not because of shadows, but because of light. Elphaba kept turning corners into the summer sun that, setting, was bowling blinding shafts of light along side streets, through arcades, over the walls of gardens. But he had had many years of practice at stalking animals under similar conditions. Nowhere in Oz was the sun as much an adversary as in the thousand-year grasslands. He knew to squint his eyes and follow the persistence of motion, and forget about identifying by shape. He also knew how to duck sideways without tipping over or losing his balance, how to crouch suddenly, how to look for other clues that the prey had begun to move again, the startled birds, the change in sound, the disrupted wind. She could not lose him, and she could not know he was on her trail. So he wound halfway across the city, from the elegant city center to the low-rent warehouse district, in whose shadowy doorways the destitute made their malodorous homes. Within spitting distance of an army barracks, Elphaba stopped before a boarded-up corn exchange, ferreted a key from some inner pocket, and opened the door. He called from a short distance, in an ordinary voice, "Fabula!" Even in the act of turning, she caught herself and tried to rearrange her expression, but it was too late. She had shown that she recognized him, and she realized it. His foot was blocking the way before she could slam the heavy door shut. "Are you in trouble?" he asked. "Leave me alone," she said. "Please, please." "You're in trouble. Let me in." "You're trouble. Stay out." Pure Elphaba. His last doubts fled. He cracked the door open with his shoulder. "You're making me into a monster," he said, grunting with the effort. She was strong. "I'm not going to rob you or rape you. I just won't be ignored like that." "Why?" She gave up then, and he fell stupidly against the unplastered brick wall of the stairwell, like a pratfalling twit in a vaudeville hour. "I remembered you as full of delicacy and grace," she said. "Did you catch something by accident, or did you study awkwardness?" "Come on," he said. "You force someone to behave like a clumping boor. You give them no choice. Don't be so surprised. I can still manage grace. I can do delicacy. Half a minute." "Shiz got to you," she said, eyebrows up, but mockingly. She wasn't really surprised. "Listen to those graduate school affectations. Where's the native boy wreaking that appealing naivete like a well-chosen musk?" "You're looking well, too," he said, a bit hurt. "Do you live in this stairwell, or are we going someplace even a little bit homey?" She cursed and mounted the stairs. They were covered with mouse turds and scraps of packing straw. A soupy evening light seeped in the grimy gray glass windows. At a bend in the stairs, a white cat was waiting, haughty and disaffected like all its kin. "Malky, Malky, meow, meow," said Elphaba as she passed it, and it deigned to follow her up to the pointy arched doorway at the top of the stairs. "You're familiar?" said Fiero. "Oh, that's rich," said Elphaba. "Well, I'd as soon be thought a witch as anything else. Why not? Here, Malky, some milk." The room was large and seemed only casually arranged for dwelling. Originally a storeroom, it had barricaded double doors that could be swung outward to receive or dispense sacks of grain hauled up by a winch from the street. The only natural light fell in through a couple of cracked panes of glass in a skylight open 4 or 5 inches. Pigeon feathers and white and bloody flux on the floor below. 8 or 10 crates in a circle as if for sitting. A bedroll. Clothes folded on a trunk. Some odd feathers, bits of bones, strung teeth, and a wizened dodo claw, brown and twisted like beef jerky. These were hung on nails pounded into the wall and arranged for art or for a spell. A sallow wood table, a nice piece of furniture that, whose three arching legs tapered down into elegantly carved doe's hooves. A few tin plates, red with white speckles. Some food wrapped in cloth and cord. A pile of books at the bedside. A cat toy tied to a string. Most effectively and gruesomely, the skull of an elephant hung on a rafter, and a bouquet of dried creamy pink roses emerged from the central hole in the hull of its cranium. Like the exploding brains of a dying animal, he couldn't help thinking, remembering Elphaba's youthful concerns. Or maybe an homage to the putative magical talents of elephants. Below it hung a crude glass oval, scratched and chipped, used as a looking-glass, perhaps, though its reflective qualities appeared unreliable. "So this is home," said Fiyero, as Elphaba brought out some food for the cat and ignored Fiyero some more. "Ask me no questions, and I'll spell you no lies," she said. "May I sit down?" "That's a question." But she was grinning. "Oh, well, then, sit for 10 minutes and tell me about yourself. How did you, of all people, turn into a sophisticate?"
"Appearances are deceiving," he said.
"I can afford the garb and affect the language, but I'm still an Arjiki tribal boy underneath." "What is your life like?"
"Is there something to drink? Not alcohol. I'm just thirsty."
"I don't have running water. I don't use it. There's some questionable milk, at least Malky will still drink it. Or perhaps there's a bottle of ale up there on the shelf. Help yourself."
She took a little ale in a pipkin, left the rest for him.
He told her the barest outline of things, his wife, Sarima, the childhood bride grown up and grown fecund, their three children, the old Office of Public Works, Waterworks headquarters at Kiamo Co., which by ambush and occupation his father had converted to a chieftain's seat and a tribal stronghold back in the time of the Ozma Regent. The dizzying schizoid life of moving every year from the thousand-year grasslands in the spring and summer, where the clan hunted and feasted, to a more settled autumn and winter at Kiamo Co.
"An Arjiki prince has business interests here in the Emerald City," said Elphaba. "If it were banking, you'd be in shiz. The business of this city is military, my old friend. What are you up to?"
"You've heard enough from me," he said. "I can play coy and deceptive, too, even if it's all pretend and no dark secrets to speak of." He guessed the quiet business of trade agreements would not impress his old friend. He was embarrassed his affairs weren't more audacious or thrilling. "But I've gone on. What of you, Elfie?"
She wouldn't say anything for a few minutes. She unrolled some dried sausage and some graying bread and found a couple of oranges and a lemon and put them unceremoniously on the table. In the mothy atmosphere, she looked more like a shadow than a person. Her green skin seemed oddly soft, like spring leaves at their tenderest, and beaten like copper. He had an unprecedented urge to grab her wrist and make her stop moving about, if not to make her talk, at least to keep her still so he could look at her.
"Eat this stuff," she said at last. "I'm not hungry. You eat it. Go on."
"Tell me something," he begged. "You left us at Shiz. You disappeared like the morning fog. Why? Where to? And what then?"
"How poetic you are," she said. "I've a notion that poetry is the highest form of self-deception."
Don't change the subject. But she was agitated. Her fingers twitched. She called for the cat, and then irritated it and sent it flying off her lap. Finally she said, "Oh, well, this much then. But you're never to come here again. I don't want to have to find a new place. This is too good for me. Do you promise?"
"I will agree to consider promising, that's all. How can I promise any more than that? I don't know a thing yet."
She said hurriedly, "Well, I was fed up with Shiz. The death of Dr. Dillamon vexed me, and everybody grieved and nobody cared. Not really. It wasn't the right place for me anyway. All those silly girls. Although I liked Glinda well enough. How is she, anyway?"
"I'm not in touch. I keep expecting to run into her at some palace reception or other. I hear through the grapevine that she married a Paltos baronet."
Elphaba looked annoyed, and her back stiffened. "Only a baronet? Not a baron or a viscount, at least? What a disappointment! Her early promise was never to pan out, then."
Meant as a joke, her remark was stiff and unfunny.
"Is she a mother?"
"I don't know. I'm asking the questions now, remember?"
"Yes, but palace receptions?" she said. "Are you in cahoots with our glorious wizard?"
"I hear he's mostly gone reclusive. I've never met him," Fiyero said. "He shows up at the opera and listens behind a portable screen. At his own formal dinners he dines apart, in an adjoining chamber, behind a carved marble grill.
I've seen a profile of a stately man walking along a promenade. If that's even the wizard, that's all I've met of him. But you, why did you cut us all off?"
"I loved you too much to keep in touch."
"What does that mean?"
"Don't ask me," she said, thrashing a bit, her arms like oars rowing in the blue summer evening lightlessness.
"Yes, I am asking. Have you lived here ever since, for 5 years? Do you study? Do you work?"
He rubbed his bare forearms as he tried to guess about her. What would she be up to?
"Are you associated with the Animal Relief League, or one of those defiant little humanitarian organizations?" "I never use the words humanist or humanitarian, as it seems to me that to be human is to be capable of the most heinous crimes in nature."
"You're evading again."
"That's my job," she said. "There, that's a clue for you, dear Fiyero."
"Amplify."
"I went underground," she said softly. "And I am still underground. You're the first one to crack my anonymity since I said goodbye to Glinda 5 years ago. So you now know why I can't say any more, or why you can't see me again. For all I know, you will turn me into the Gale Force."
"Ha! Those martinets? You think very little of me if you think I..."
"How do I know? How could I know?"
She twisted her fingers together, a puzzle of green sticks.
"They march in those boots all over the poor and the weak. They terrify households at 3 in the morning and drag away dissenters and break up printing presses with their axes and hold mock trials for treason at midnight and executions at dawn. They rake over every quarter of this beautiful false city. They harvest a crop of victims on a monthly basis. It's government by terror. They could be massing on the street right now. Never having yet followed me, they may have followed you."
"You're not as hard to follow as you think," he told her. "You're good, but not that good. I could teach you a few things."
"I bet you could," she said. "But you won't, for we won't meet again. It's too dangerous for you as well as for me. That's what I mean when I say I loved you all too much to keep in touch. Do you think the Gale Force is above torturing friends and family to get at sensitive information? You've got a wife and children, and I'm merely an old college friend you ran into once. Clever you to have followed me. Never again, do you hear? I will move if I find you're trailing me. I can pick up right now and be away in 30 seconds. It's my training.
Don't do this to me, he said.
We're old friends, she said, but we're not even especially good friends. Don't turn this into a sentimental rendezvous. It's nice to see you, but I don't ever want to see you again. Take care of yourself and beware high connections with bastards, because when the revolution comes, there won't be mercy for toadying ass-lickers.
At, what, 23 years old, you're playing the Lady Rebel? He said. It's not becoming.
It's unbecoming, she agreed. A perfect word for my new life. Unbecoming. I, who have always been unbecoming, am becoming un. Though I point out you are the same age as I, and prancing about as a prince. But have you eaten enough? We have to say goodbye now.
We don't, he said firmly.
He wanted to take her hands in his. He didn't remember that he'd ever touched her before. He corrected himself. He knew he never had. It was almost as if she could read his mind. You know who you are, she said. But you don't know who I am. You can't. I mean, you can't and you can't. It's not allowed, for one, and you're not capable for the other. Godspeed, if they use that phrase in the Vincas, if it's not a curse. Godspeed, Fiero. She handed him his opera cape and held out her hand to shake his. He grabbed her hand and looked up into her face, which just for a second had fallen open. What he saw there made him chill and hot flash in dizzying simultaneity with the shape and scale of its need.
"What do you hear of Bach?" she asked, the next time they met.
"You just won't answer me anything about yourself, will you?" he said. He was lounging with his feet up on her table. "Why did you finally agree to let me come back if you keep yourself locked up like a prisoner?"
"I rather liked Bach, that's all," she grinned.
"I let you come back so I could pump you for news of him and of the others." He told her what he knew. Bach had married Miss Miller, of all surprising turns. She had been dragged out to Nest Harding's, and she hated it. She kept trying suicide.
His letters, sent at Lerlinmas every year, are hysterical. They annotate her failed attempts at killing herself like a sort of annual family report.
It makes me wonder, in the same circumstances, what my mother must have gone through, said Elphaba. The privileged childhood in the big home of the ascendancy, then the rude shock of a hard life out there in nowhere land. In Mama's case, from Colwyn Grounds to Rush Margins, then the Quadling Lowlands. It's actually a penance of the most severe sort.
Like mother, like daughter, said Fiero. Haven't you left a certain amount of privilege yourself to live here like a snail, hidden and private?
I remember the first time I saw you, she said, shaking drops of vinegar over the roots and vegetables she was preparing for a supper. It was in that lecture hall of what's-his-name,
Dr. Nikodik, said Fiero. He blushed.
You had those beautiful markings on your face. I'd never seen such before. Did you plan that entrance to win your way into our hearts?
On my honor, could I have done anything else I would have? I was both mortified and terrified. Do you know, I thought those enchanted antlers were going to kill me. And it was Prancing Crope and Flibberty Tibbet who saved me.
Crope and Tibbet! Tibbet and Crope! I'd forgotten all about them. How are they?
Tibbet was never the same after that escapade at the Philosophy Club.
Crope, I think, entered an arts auction house and still flits around with the theatrical set. I see him from time to time at occasions. We don't speak.
My, you're disapproving, she laughed.
Of course, being as prurient as the next creature, I always wondered what the philosophy club had turned out to be like. You know, in another life, I'd like to see them all again. And Glinda, dear Glinda, and even nasty Averick, what of him?
Averick I do speak to. He's most of the year installed in the Margravate, but he has a house in Chiz, and when in the Emerald City we stay at the same club.
Is he still a smug boor?
My, you're disapproving now.
I suppose I am.
They ate their dinner. Fiero waited for her to ask more about his family, but it was their respective families they were keeping from each other, apparently. His Vincus wife and children, her circle of agitators and insurrectionists. The next time he came, he thought, he must wear a shirt open at the neck, so she could see that the pattern of blue diamonds on his face continued unbroken down his chest, since she seemed to like that.
"Surely you don't spend the entire autumn season in the Emerald City?" she asked one evening when the cold was drawing in.
"I've sent word to Sarima that business is keeping me here indefinitely. She doesn't care. How could she care? Plucked out of a filthy caravansary and married as a small child to an Arjiki prince? Her family wasn't stupid. She's got food, servants, and the solid stone walls of Kiamo Ko for defense against the other tribes. She's going a little fat after her third child. She doesn't really notice whether I'm home or not. Well, she has five sisters, and they all moved in. I married a harem."
"No!"
Elphaba sounded intrigued and a little embarrassed at the idea.
"You're right. No, not really. Sarima has proposed once or twice that her younger sisters could and would happily occupy my energies at night time. Once you pass over the Great Kells, the taboo against such an exercise isn't as strong as it seems to be in the rest of Oz, so stop looking so shocked."
"I can't help it."
"Did you do it?"
"Did I do it?"
He was teasing her.
"Did you sleep with your sisters-in-law?"
"No," he said. "Not out of lofty moral standards, or a lack of interest either. It's just that Sarima is a shrewd wife, and everything in marriage is a campaign. I would have been in her thrall even more than I am."
"Such a bad thing?"
"You're not married. You don't know."
"Yes, a bad thing."
"I am married," she said. "Just not to a man."
He raised his eyebrows.
She put her hands to her face. He'd never seen her look like that. Her words had shocked herself. She had to turn her head away for an instant, clear her throat, blow her nose.
"Oh, damn! Tears! They burn like fire!" she cried, suddenly in a fury, and ran for an old blanket to dab her eyes before the salty wetness could run down her cheeks. She stood bent over like an old woman, one arm on the counter, the blanket falling from her face to the floor.
"Elfie! Elfie!" he said, horrified, and lurched after her and put his arms around her. The blanket hung between them, chin to ankles, but seemed about to burst into flame itself, or roses, or a fountain of champagne and incense. Odd how the richest images bloomed in the mind when the body itself was most alert.
"No," she cried. "No, no, I'm not a harem. I'm not a woman. I'm not a person, no."
But her arms wheeled of their own accord like windmill sails, like those magicked antlers, not to kill him, but to pin him with love, to mount him against the wall. Malky, with a rare display of discretion, climbed to the window-sill and looked away from them. They conducted their love affair in the room above the abandoned corn exchange as the autumn weather came lop-leggedly in from the east. Now a warm day, now a sunny one, now 4 days of cold winds and thin rain. There were long days in a row when they couldn't meet. "I have business. I have work. Trust me, or I shall disappear on you," she said. "I shall write to Glinda and ask her to share the spell on how to go up in a puff of smoke. I am teasing, but I mean it, Fiero." "Fiero plus Fay," he wrote, in the flour that spilled when she rolled out a pie crust. Fay, she had whispered, as if even to keep it from the cat, was her code name. No one in the cell could know one another's real names. She would not let him see her naked in the light, but since he also was not allowed to visit during the day, this was hardly a problem. She waited for him on the appointed evenings, sitting naked under the blanket, reading essays on political theory or moral philosophy. "I don't know that I understand them. I read them as poetry," she once admitted. "I like the sound of the words, but I don't ever really expect my slow, slanted impression of the world to change by what I read." "Is it changing by how you live?" he asked, turning down the light and slipping out of his clothes. "You think all this is new to me," she said, sighing. "You think I am such a virgin." "You didn't bleed the first time," he observed. "So what's to think about?" "I know what you think," she said. "But how experienced are you, Lord Sir Fiero, Arjiki Prince of Kiamoko, mightiest stalker of the thousand-year grasslands, chiefest chieftain in the great Kells?" "I am putty in your hands," he said truthfully. "I married a child bride, and to preserve my power I haven't been unfaithful until now." "You are not like her," he said. "You don't feel like her. It doesn't feel the same. You're more secret." "I don't exist," she said. "So you're still not being unfaithful either." "Let's not be unfaithful right now, then," he said. "I can't wait." Running his hands along her ribs, down the tight plane of her stomach. She always brought his hands to her thin, expressive breasts. She would not be touched below the waist by hands. They moved together, blue diamonds on a green field. He didn't have enough to do during the days. Being the chieftain of the Arjiki people, he knew it was in their political interest to be tied ineluctably to the commercial hub of the Emerald City. Yet Arjiki business concerns only required Fiero to show his face at social engagements, in board meetings, and financial parlors. The rest of the time he wandered about, seeking frescoes of St. Glinda and other saints. Elphaba Fabula Elphi Fay would never tell him what she had been doing in the chapel of St. Glinda, attached to the montery in St. Glinda Square. One day he looked up Averick, and they had lunch. Averick suggested a girly show afterward, and Fiero begged off. Averick was opinionated, cynical, corrupt, and as good-looking as ever. There wasn't much gossip to bring back to Elphaba. The wind tore the leaves from the trees. The gale force continued to frog-march animals and collaborators out of town. Interest rates in the Gillikin banks went soaring up. Good for investors, bad for those who had adjustable-rate loans. Foreclosures on a lot of valuable city center properties. Too early, businesses began stringing the green and gold lights of Lurleenmas, trying to woo cautious and depressed citizens into the shops. More than anything else, he wanted to walk the streets of the Emerald City with Elphaba. There was no more beautiful place to be in love, especially at dusk, as the shop lights went on, golden against the blue-purple evening sky. He had never been in love before, he now saw. It humbled him. It scared him. He couldn't bear it when their forced absence went 4 or 5 days. "Kisses to Irgi, Manek, and Noor," he wrote on the bottom of his weekly letter to Sarima, who couldn't write back because, among other things, she had never learned either alphabet. Somehow her silence seemed a tacit approval of this vow-shattering interlude. He didn't write kisses to her, too. He hoped the chocolates would do. He rolled over, tugging the blanket with him. She tugged it back. The air in the room was so cold it seemed clammy. Malky endured their thrashing legs in order to stay near them, to receive warmth, and to give whatever passes for affection in cats. "My darling Fay," said Fiero, "you probably know this, and I'm not about to become a co-conspirator at whatever it is you're working for, reducing library fines, or revoking the need for cat collars or whatever. But I do keep my ears open. The Quadlings are under the thumb of the marching militia again. At least, that's what they're saying in the lounge of the club, over newspapers and pipes. Apparently an army division has gone down into Quadling country as far as Coyer, on some sort of a slash-and-burn mission. Your father, your brother, and Nessa Rose, are they still there?" Elphaba didn't answer for a while. She seemed to be working out not only what she wanted to say, but perhaps even what she could remember. Her expression was of puzzlement, even testiness. She said, "We lived in Coyer for a time, when I was about 10. It's a funny little low town, built on boggy ground. Half the streets are canals. The roofs are low, the windows are grilled or louvered to provide privacy and ventilation. The air is steamy and the flora excessive. Huge roundels of palmy leaf, almost like shallow quilted pillows, making a sound as they beat against each other in the wind. Tur, 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 tur." "I don't know that there's much of Quire left," said Fiero carefully, "if the gossip I picked up is accurate." "No, Papa isn't there now, thank whoever, whatever, thank nothing," continued Elphaba, "unless things have changed. The good people of Quire weren't very responsive to missionary efforts. They'd invite Papa and me in, serve us little damp cakelets and lukewarm red mint tea. We'd all sit on low, mildewing cushions, scaring geckos and spiders into the deeper shadows. Papa would drone on about the generous nature of the unnamed god, doing his basic xenophiliac slant. He pointed to me as proof. I would grin with horrible sweetness and sing a hymn, the only music Papa approved of. I was miserably shy and ashamed of my color, but Papa had convinced me of the value of this work. Invariably, the gentle citizens of Quire would capitulate out of hospitality. They'd allow themselves to be led in prayers to the unnamed god, but you couldn't say their hearts were in it. I think I sensed a great deal more dishearteningly than Papa did, how ineffectual we really were."
"So where are they now, Papa, Nessa Rose, and the boy, your brother, what's his name?"
"Shell, that's his name. Well, Papa felt his work was farther south in Quadling country, in the real outback. We had a series of small cramped homes around ovals. The hovels and ovals, we called them. That dreary, beastly countryside, full of a bloody beauty. At his questioning expression, she continued. I mean, 15-20 years ago, Fiyero, the Emerald City speculators discovered the ruby deposits there, first under the Ozma regent, then after the coup under the wizard. Same ugly business practices. Though under the Ozma regent, the exploitation did not require murder and brutality. Using elephants, the engineers hauled in gravel, they dammed up springs, they perfected a complicated system of strip mining under 3 feet of brackish groundwater. Papa thought this disarray in their little moist society was a situation ready-made for mission work, and he was right. The Quadlings struggled against the wizard with ill-argued proclamations. They resorted to totems, but their only military weapons were slingshots. So they rallied around my father. He converted them. They went into the struggle with the zeal of the newly chastised. They were dispossessed and disappeared. All with the benefit of Unionist grace. My, you're bitter. I was a tool. My dear father used me, and Nessa Rose less so, because of her trouble moving about. He used me as an object lesson. Looking as I did, even singing as I can, they trusted him partly as a response to the freakiness of me. If the unnamed god could love me, how much more responsible it'd be to the unadulterated them? So, my dear, you don't care where he is or what happens to him now? How can you say that? She sat up, steaming. I love the mad old tunnel-visioned bastard. He really believed in what he preached. He even thought that a Quadling corpse found floating face up in a brackwater pond, provided it had a tattoo of conversion on it somewhere, was better off than a survivor. He felt he'd written a single ticket to the Otherland Assembly of the Unnamed God. I think he considered it work well done. And you don't? Fiyero had a fairly anemic spiritual life. He felt unqualified to voice an opinion about her father's vocation. Maybe it was work well done, she said sadly. How do I know? But not for me. Settlement by settlement we reaped converts. Settlement by settlement the Civil Engineering Corps came in to detonate the village life. There was no outcry throughout Oz proper. Nobody was listening. Who cared about the Quadlings? But what brought him there in the first place? He and Mama had a friend, a Quadling, who died in my family home, a Quadling itinerant, a glassblower. Elphaba frowned and closed her eyes and would say no more. Fiyero kissed her fingernails. He kissed the V between her thumb and forefinger. He sucked on it as if it were a lemon rind. She slipped backward to allow him greater purchase. A while later, he said, "But Elfi Fabula Fay, are you really not worried about your father and Nessa Rose and little Himihu?" "My father chases hopeless causes. It gives his failure at life some legitimacy. For a while he proclaimed himself a prophet of the return of the last lost tadpole of the Ozma line. That's over now. And my brother Shell, he is probably 15 by now. Look, Fiyero, how can I be worried about them and be worried about the campaign of the season, too?" I can't course around Oz on that broomstick there like a storybook witch. I've chosen to go underground so that I can't worry. Besides, I know what will happen to Nessa Rose at least, sooner or later. What? When my great-grandfather finally pops off, she'll be the next eminent Throp. You're in line, I thought. Aren't you older? I'm gone, dearie. I'm magicked away in a puff of smoke. Forget it. And you know, that'll be good for Nessa Rose. She'll be a sort of local queen out there in Nest Hardings.
She apparently did a course in sorcery, did you know, in Shiz?
No, I didn't. Well, bully for her. If she ever comes down off that plinth, the one that has words written on it along the edges in gold, reading, "Most Superior in Moral Rectitude," if she ever allows herself to be the bitch she really is, she'll be the bitch of the East. Nanny and the devoted staff at Colwyn Grounds will prop her up.
I thought you were fond of her.
Don't you know affection when you see it? Scoffed Elphaba. I love Nessie. She's a pain in the neck. She's intolerably righteous. She's a nasty piece of work. I'm devoted to her.
She'll be the eminent Throp.
Better she than I, said Elphaba dryly. For one thing, she has great taste in shoes.
One evening through the skylight, the full moon fell heavily on Elphaba sleeping. Theiro had awakened and gone to take a leak into the chamber pot. Malky was stalking mice on the stairs. Coming back, Theiro looked at the form of his lover, more pearly than green tonight. He had brought her a traditional vincus-fringed silk scarf, roses on a black background, and he had tied it around her waist, and from then on it was a costume for lovemaking. Tonight, in sleeping, she had nudged it up, and he admired the curve of her flank, the tender fragility of her knee, the bony ankle. There was a smell of perfume still in the air, and the resiny animal smell, and the smell of the mystical sea, and the sweet cloaking smell of hair, all riled up by sex. He sat by the side of the bed and looked at her. Her pubic hair grew almost more purple than black, in small spangled curls, a different pattern than Sarima's. There was an odd shadow near the groin. For a sleepy moment, he wondered if some of his blue diamonds had, in the heat of sex, been steamed onto her own skin. Or was it a scar? But she woke up just then, and in the moonlight covered herself with a blanket. She smiled at him drowsily, and called him, "Yero, my hero," and that melted his heart. She could get so angry, though. I wouldn't be surprised if the pork roll you're devouring, in such perfect mindless affluence, is cut from a pig, she snapped at him once.
Just because you've already eaten, you don't need to ruin my appetite, he protested mildly. Free-living animals were not much in evidence in his home territory, and the few sentient creatures he'd known at Shiz had, except at the philosophy club that night, made little impression. The plight of the animals had not much touched him.
This is why you shouldn't fall in love. It blinds you. Love is wicked distraction.
Now you have put me off my lunch.
He fed the rest of the pork roll to Malky.
What in the world do you know about wickedness? You're a bit player in this network of renegades, aren't you? You're a novice.
I know this. The wickedness of men is that their power breeds stupidity and blindness, she said.
And of women?
Women are weaker, but their weakness is full of cunning and an equally rigid moral certainty. Since their arena is smaller, their capacity for real damage is less alarming. Though being more intimate, they are the more treacherous.
And my capacity for evil, said Fiero, feeling implicated and uncomfortable. And yours?
Fiero's capacity for evil is in believing too strenuously in a capacity for good.
And yours?
Mine is thinking in epigrams.
You let yourself off lightly, he said, suddenly a little annoyed.
Is that what you're engaged by your secret network to do? Generate witty epigrams?
Oh, there's big doings afoot, she said uncharacteristically. I won't be at the center of it, but I'll be on the fringes helping out, believe me.
What are you talking about? A coup? Never you mind, and you'll stay blameless, just as you want to be.
This was nastiness on her part.
An assassination? And so what if you do kill some general butcher? What does that make you, a saint? A saint of the revolution? Or a martyr if you're killed in the campaign?
She wouldn't answer.
She shook her narrow head in irritation, then flung the rosy shawl across the room, as if it infuriated her.
What if some innocent bystander is killed as you aim for General Pig Butcher?
I don't know or care much about martyrs, she said. All that smacks of a higher plan, a cosmology, something I don't believe in. If we can't comprehend the plan at hand, how could a higher plan make any more sense? But were I to believe in martyrdom, I suppose I'd say you can only be a martyr if you know what you are dying for and choose it.
Ah, so then there are innocent victims in this trade, those who don't choose to die but are in the line of fire.
There are, there will be, accidents, I guess.
Can there be grief, regret, in your exalted circle? Is there any such thing as a mistake? Is there a concept of tragedy?
Fiero, you disaffected fool, the tragedy is all around us. Worrying about anything smaller is a distraction. Any casualty of the struggle is their fault, not ours. We don't embrace violence, but we don't deny its existence. How can we deny it when its effects are all around us? That kind of denial is a sin, if anything is.
Ah, now I've heard the word I never expected to hear you say.
Denial? Sin?
No, we.
I don't know why.
The lone dissenter at Craige Hall turns institutional, a company gal, a team player, our former Miss Queen of Solitaire?
You misunderstand. There is a campaign, but no agents. There is a game, but no players. I have no colleagues. I have no self. I never did, in fact, but that's beside the point. I am just a muscular twitch in the larger organism.
Ha! You the most individual, the most separate, the most real.
Like everyone else, you refer to my looks, and you make fun of them.
I adore your looks, and I acknowledge them, Fay.
They parted that day without speaking, and he spent the evening at the betting parlor losing money.
The next time he saw her, he brought 3 green candles and 3 gold candles, and decorated her flat for Lurleenmas.
"I don't believe in religious feast days," she said, but relented to admit. "They are pretty, though."
"You have no soul," he teased her.
"You're right," she answered soberly. "I didn't think it showed."
"You're only playing word games now."
"No," she said. "What proof have I of a soul?"
"How can you have a conscience if you don't have a soul?" he asked, despite himself. He wanted to keep things light, to get back onto a better footing after their last episode of moral wrestling and estrangement.
"How can a bird feed its young if it has no consciousness of before and after? A conscience, Hero, my hero, is only consciousness in another dimension, the dimension of time. What you call conscience, I prefer to call instinct.
Birds feed their young without understanding why, without weeping about how all that is born must die, sob, sob. I do my work with a similar motivation, the movement in the gut toward food, fairness, and safety. I am a pack animal wheeling with the herd, that's all. I'm a forgettable leaf on a tree.
Since your work is terrorism, that's the most extreme argument for crime I've ever heard. You're eschewing all personal responsibility. It's as bad as those who sacrifice their personal will into the gloomy morasses of the unknowable will of some unnameable god. If you suppress the idea of personhood, then you suppress the notion of individual culpability.
What is worse, Fiero? Suppressing the idea of personhood, or suppressing, through torture and incarceration and starvation, real living persons? Look, would you worry about saving one precious sentimental portrait in a museum of fine arts, when the city around you is on fire and real people are burning to death? Keep some proportion in all this.
But even some innocent bystander, say an annoying society dame, is a real person, not a portrait. Your metaphor is distracting and belittling. It's a blind excuse for crime.
A society dame has chosen to parade herself as a living portrait. She must be treated as such. It's her due. That denial of it, that's your evil, to go back to the other day. I say you save the innocent bystander if you can, even if she's a society dame, or he's a captain of industry, thriving mightily on all these repressive moves. But not at the expense of other realer people. And if you can't save them, you can't. Everything costs.
I don't believe in this concept of real or realer people.
You don't? She smiled, not nicely. When I do disappear again, dearie, I'll surely be less real than I am now.
She made to simulate sex against him. He turned his head, surprised at the vigor of his aversion.
Later that night, when they had made up, she suffered a racking paroxysm and painful sweats. She would not let him touch her.
"You should go away. I'm not worthy of you," she moaned. And some time later, when she was calmer, she murmured before sleeping again, "I love you so much, Fiero. You just don't understand. Being born with a talent or an inclination for goodness is the aberration." She was right. He didn't understand. He wiped her brow with a dry towel and kept close to her. There was frost on the skylight, and they slept beneath their winter coats to keep warm. One brisk afternoon, he sent off a propitiatory package of bright wooden toys for the children and a jeweled torque for Serima. The pack train was going around the Great Kells via the northern route. It wouldn't deliver Lurlinma's presents to Kiamo Ko until well into the spring, but he could pretend to have sent them earlier. If the snows held off, he would be home by then, restless and chafing in the tall, narrow rooms of the mountain stronghold. But maybe he would get the credit for thoughtfulness. And perhaps deserved. Why not? To be sure, Serima would be in her winter doldrums, as distinct from her spring moods, her summer ennui, and her congenital autumn condition. A torque, eventually, would cheer her up, at least a little. He stopped for a coffee and a café in a neighborhood just enough off the beaten track to be both bohemian and pricey. The management apologized. The winter garden, usually heated with braziers and brazen with expensive forced flowers, had been the site of an explosion the night before.
"The neighborhood is troubled. Who'd have thought it?" said the manager, touching Fiero on the elbow. "Our glorious wizard was to have eradicated civil unrest. Wasn't that the whole point of curfews and containment laws?
Fiero was not inclined to comment, and the manager took his silence for agreement.
I've moved a few tables into my private parlor up the stairs. If you don't mind roughing it amidst my family memorabilia, he said, leading the way. Finding good Munchkinlander help to repair the damage is getting harder, too. The Munchkinlander tick-tock touch, there's nothing like it. But a lot of our friends in the service sector have gone back to their eastern farms, scared of violence against them.
Well, so many of them are so small, don't you think they seem to provoke it? They're all cowards.
He interrupted himself to say,
I can tell you have no Munchkinlander relatives, or I wouldn't comment this way.
My wife is from Nest Hardings, said Fiero, lying unconvincingly, but the point was made.
I recommend the cherry chocolate frappe today, fresh and delicious, said the manager, retreating into repentant formality and pulling out a chair at a table near high old windows.
Fiero sat and looked out. One fretted shutter had warped and couldn't fold back against the outer wall as designed, but there was still enough of a view. Roof lines, ornamental chimney pots, the odd high window box stuffed with dark winter pansies, and pigeons swooping and scissoring like lords of the sky. The manager was of that peculiar stock. After so many generations in the Emerald City, it seemed a separate ethnic strand. The paintings of his family showed the bright gimlet hazel eyes, and refined receding hairlines on men and women alike, and plucked into the scalps of children, too, in the fashion of the Emerald City upwardly yearning middle class. At the sight of simpering boys in pink satin with frizzy-headed lapdogs, and girlettes in womanish dark rouge and plunging necklines, revealing their innocent lack of breasts, Fiero felt the sudden longing again for his own cold and distant children. Though bruised by their particular family life, and who wasn't? In his memory, Irgi, Manek, and Noor managed more integrity than these hothouse scions of a family on the make. But that was cruel, and he was responding to artistic convention, not to the actual children. He turned his gaze out the window when the order came, to avoid hideous art, to avoid the other people in the salon. Having coffee in the winter garden below usually provided a view of vine-covered brick walls, shrubs, and the occasional marble statue of some improbably beautiful and vulnerably naked stripling. However, from a flight up, one could see over the wall into an interior mews area. One part was a stables, another a neighborhood toilet, apparently. And just within the range of his vision was the wall broken by the explosion. Some sort of twisted, thorny wire netting had been erected across the opening, which led into a schoolyard. As he watched, one of the doors of the adjacent school was pushed open, and a small crowd emerged, shaking and stretching into the sunlight. There seemed to be, Fiero peered, a couple of elderly quaddling women and some adolescent male quaddlings, straplings with early mustaches making a bluish-colored shadow against their fine rose-rust skin. 5, 6, 7 quaddlings, and a couple of stout men who might have been part Gilliconese. It was hard to tell. And a family of bears. No, bears. Smallish, red bears, a mother and father and a toddler. The little bear went unerringly to some balls and hoops under the stairs. The quaddlings made a circle and began to sing and dance. The old ones, with arthritic steps, joined their hands with the teenagers and moved in a Widdershins pattern in and out, as if making a clock face that reversed the clockwise movement of time. The stocky Gilliconese men shared a cigarette and gazed out the wiry barrier across the break in the wall. The Red Bears were more dispirited. The male sat on the wooden edge of the sandlot, rubbing his eyes and combing the fur below his chin. The female moved back and forth, kicking at the ball just often enough to keep the cub occupied, then stroking the bowed head of her mate. Fiero sipped his drink and inched forward. If there were, what, 12 prisoners, and only a wire fence between them and freedom, why didn't they rush it? Why were they separated into their racial and species groups? After 10 minutes, the doors opened again, and a gale forcer came out, trim and, yes, Fiero had to admit it at last, terrifying. Terrifying in the brick-red uniform with the green boots and the emerald cross that quartered the breast of the shirt, one vertical strap from groin to high-starched collar, the other strap from armpit to armpit across the pectorals. He was only a youth whose curly hair was so blonde as to look nearly white in the winter sun. He stood with legs apart on the step of the school's veranda. Though Fiero couldn't hear a thing through the closed window, the soldier apparently gave a command. The bears stiffened, and the cub began to wail and clutch the ball to itself. The Gilliconese men came and stood quiescently ready. The quadlings ignored the order and kept on with their dance. They swung their hips, and they held their arms at shoulder height, moving their hands in a semaphoric message, though what it meant Fiero could only guess. He had never seen a quadling before. The gale forcer raised his voice. He had a truncheon in a thong loop at his waist. The cub hid behind the father, and the mother could be seen to growl. "Work together," Fiero found himself thinking, hardly aware he could have such a thought. "Work as a team. There are 12 of you and only one of him. Is it your differences from one another that keep you docile? Or are there relatives inside who will be tortured if you make a break for freedom?" It was all speculation. Fiero couldn't tell the dynamics of the situation, but he was riveted. He realized his hand was open, palm up against the glass of the window. Below, because the bears had not stood to join the lineup, the soldier raised his cudgel and it came down on the skull of the cub. Fiero's body jerked. He spilled his drink, and the cup broke, porcelain shards on the buttery herringbone-laid oak flooring. The manager appeared from behind a green baize door and tutted and twitched the drapes closed, but not before Fiero had seen one last thing. Recoiling as if he had never hunted and killed in the thousand-year grasslands, he averted his eyes and they wheeled upward, where he glimpsed the pale blonde coins of faces, 2 or 3 dozen schoolchildren in the upper windows of the school, staring down with fascination and open mouths at the scene in their playing field. "They have no concern for neighbors who have a business to run, bills to pay, and loved ones to feed."